Rainmaking, the affirmation of something that is true, can also cause the rain to fall. This is evident in the paritta of the fish who was a bodhisattva. Here, the cure of poisoning and other afflictions and rainmaking through the affirmation of truth to be effected only by those who avoid lying. The potency of truth will become manifest only when they affirm something that is true concerning their private lives. King Sutasoma, in connection with the abstinence from telling lies, King Sutasoma's faithfulness to his principles is very interesting, and a brief account of this king is in order. To distinguish him from his namesake in the Jatakas, the commentaries refer to him as Maha Sutasoma, but here we will call him Sutasoma. Porisada, in the story of King Sutasoma, is well known to many Buddhists. Some have the Porisada figure tattooed on their bodies. Originally, he was King Brahmadatta of Benares in the kingdom of Kasi. As he had been an ogre in many of his previous lives, he was very fond of meat and never had meatless meals. By and large, people today are also fond of meat. All over the world, those who avoid meat are few and far between. Only the high caste Hindus of India are well known as the community of non-meat eaters. There are only a few vegetarians in other countries. Doctors recommend meat as a nourishing food, and of course their advice fits in with mankind's partiality for meat. A cannibal in exile. The king of Benares scorned meatless meal, and so the royal cook had to serve him meat every day. Then one day, no meat was available as the slaughter of animals was forbidden on that day. Fearing punishment, the cook went to the cemetery, cut off a piece of flesh from a fresh corpse, and after cooking it, served the human meat to the king. In ancient India, it was customary to send a dead body to the cemetery immediately after death. The king found the human meat very delicious, and he asked the cook what kind of meat it was. Rasika, the cook, dared not say anything, but when threatened with death, he was forced to reveal the truth. Then the king ordered him to serve human meat every day. Rasika killed the condemned prisoners in the jail to get meat for the king. When there was no condemned prisoners left in the jail, the cook killed one man every night. At last, the king's cannibalism was found out, and he was banished by the chief of the army and the citizens. Porisada, the cannibal. The king left the country, and with his cook, he took up abode under a big banyan tree in the forest. He killed travellers coming along the path and lived on human meat prepared by his cook. So he was called Porisada. Pori equals human flesh. Sada, eater, a cannibal. One day, Porisada came back empty-handed. He told the cook to put the pot on fire. The cook asked him about meat, but he said, "Oh, don't bother, we will get it." Rasika was quite frightened. Trembling with fear that his turn had come, he made a fire and put the pot on it. Then Porisada killed and cooked him for his meal. So we have the saying that when nothing was available, Rasika was expendable. After that, Porisada was left alone. He pounced on the travellers passing through the forest and prepared his meals. One day, a Brahmin who travelled with many escorts fell into his hands. With the escorts chasing him relentlessly, he jumped over a hedge and got his foot pierced by a sharp edge of a wooden stump. Thus seriously injured, he abandoned his captive and lay down under the banyan tree. He besought the tree god to help him heal his wound and promised to offer the blood sacrifice of 101 kings if his prayer was fulfilled. We learned something about the propitiation of gnats, nature spirits, when we were young. A village woman would, for example, appeal to the gnats for the recovery of her sick child, promising to do something in return for their help. In fact, gnats cannot cure a disease, but owing to their ignorance, women in rural areas rely on gnats in accordance with their age-old beliefs. Perhaps because he was deprived of food, Porisada's wound quickly healed up in a week. He attributed the healing to the tree god's will, and true to his pledge, he captured 100 kings within a week, tied them with a cord, and kept them together at the foot of the banyan tree. India, or Jambudipa as it is called in the sacred books, is between 2,000 or 3,000 miles wide from east to west and north to south. He would have made 100 trips, each trip covering such a long distance. As he is said to have spent only a week for the capture of the kings, it must have taken him only 168 working hours, which means on the average of 2-hour round trip for each king. Thus, it must have been impossible for him to capture the kings from all over India. Most probably his captives were only rulers of local city-states. One of the kings not included among the captives was Suta Soma. As he was once under the tutelage of Suta Soma, Porisada thought it inadvisable to capture his former master. And so he proceeded to make a blood sacrifice of the other kings in captivity. But the tree god knew that he had nothing to do with the cure of Porisada's footsore, and he did not relish the prospect of the blood sacrifice that would make his tree dirty and involve the senseless slaughter of the kings. So, on the advice of his superior gods, he made himself visible to Porisada and insisted on the capture of the famous king Suta Soma. Then Porisada set about to fulfill the wish of the tree god. The capture of Suta Soma. The next day was for King Suta Soma, an auspicious day on which he would have a ceremonial washing of his head. Before the king's security guards arrived, Porisada hid himself under a lotus leaf in the pond of the royal garden. The royal garden and its environs swarmed with regiments of war elephants, infantry, cavalry, and so forth. At the appointed hour, the king came riding an elephant with a large retinue of troops At the city gate, he saw Nanda, the Brahmin, standing on an elevated spot and blessing him. On inquiry, the king learned that the Brahmin had come to preach four gathas, stanzas, on Dhamma, each worth 100 pieces of money. The king instructed his ministers to arrange suitable accommodation for the Brahmin, and saying that he would hear the sermon on his return, proceeded to the garden. There he had his hair and beard trimmed, bathed in the pond, and then he was presented with a new robe and other regalia pertaining to royalty. At this moment, Porisada decided to capture the king, for the king's body would be heavy if he had to carry it with the robe and other royal emblems. So, brandishing his sword and shouting his name in a loud, piercing voice, he jumped out of the pond. As soon as they heard the name, Porisada, the royal guards fled helter-skelter. It is said that even the soldiers on elephants tumbled down. It was an age of heroes. A hero could then strike terror into the heart of his enemy, and he was more than a match for a host of soldiers. Today, heroism counts for little, for it is weapons, intelligence and manpower on which victory depends. But in ancient times, nobody possessed any superior weapon, and the warrior who had strength and courage was much feared. So Porisada put the soldiers to flight and ran off with the king on his shoulder. He ran fast but slowed his speed when he saw no one pursuing him. He carried Sutasoma on his shoulder instead of dragging him by his feet as he had done to other kings, for Sutasoma was his former master. As Sutasoma had just finished bathing when he was kidnapped, water drops from his hair fell onto Porisada's body. Porisada thought it was teardrops and said, "Sir, wise men usually do not weep. Are you afraid of death? Or are you worried about your family?" The king's concern. The king replied, "Porisada, I am not crying. The water drops on your body are dripping from my hair. I do not fear death, nor do I bother about my family. But there is one thing that is worrying me. When I came to the garden, I made an appointment with a Brahmin called Nanda. I am anxious to keep my promise, so if you let me go back, I give you my word that I will come back to you after seeing the Brahmin." Porisada said, "Sir, I do not believe that a man who escapes death will dare return and face it again. It is unthinkable that you would come back to your enemy after living happily in the palace with your family in attendance. Nor would it be possible for me to capture you again in the face of troops that will be guarding you." King Sutasoma replied, "Porisada, you once lived with me for a long time when I was your master. I do not tell a lie under any circumstances. If in spite of my pledge you do not trust me, I will take an oath. May I die by my own sword or spear if I do not come back to you." Porisada thought, "Kings do not swear by swords or spears. Terrible indeed is the oath this man has taken. Maybe he is really concerned over the breach of his promise to the Brahmin." Then Porisada released the king, telling him to come back without fail after he had attended to his business. Valuable stanzas. After his return to the palace, arrangements were quickly made for the sermon of the Brahmin Nanda. The four stanzas that formed the subjects of the Brahmin's discourse are worthy of note. Originally, they were preached by the Kasapa Buddha. Taking a seat that was lower than that of the Brahmin, Sutasoma heard the sermon. The first stanza says, "O King, companionship with the wise, even on a single occasion, is beneficial. Companionship with the unwise, even on many occasions, is not beneficial. A wise man avoid doing anything that is detrimental to his or another man's interest. He thinks, speaks, and acts only for his good or for the good of others. He promotes the welfare of the person with whom he associates only for a short time. But a bad man who thinks, speaks, and acts against his or other person's interest is harmful even when you come into contact with him many times." The second stanza. "One should keep company only with the wise. One should seek their advice. We should live with the wise. If we live with them, we get accustomed to their way of life and tend to emulate their good behavior. But we should seek something more than the company of a wise man. We must look up to him as our teacher and follow his advice." The stanza with which King Sutasoma learnt from the Brahmin Nanda was originally taught by Kasapa Buddha. The Brahmin came by it, as it was preached by successive generations of non-Buddhist teachers. Today there are some verses of the Buddha which pass for the original teachings of Brahminism, although they were incorporated into their scriptures by ancient Brahmins. These verses will remain part and parcel of their sacred books even after the extinction of Buddhism. The ennobling influence of parents. When one knows the teaching of the wise men, one is more ennobled than ever. It does not do him any harm. A person is morally and spiritually advanced in direct proportion to his knowledge of the wise men's teachings. Buddhists acquire knowledge of the real Buddha from their wise parents and teachers. Knowledge of an attribute of the Buddha means a step towards forward in moral character. For example, according to Arahang, an attribute which denotes freedom from defilements, we know that the Buddha was free from unwholesome desire, unwholesome ill will, and unwholesome ignorance. This knowledge helps us to revere the memory of the Buddha and enhances our spiritual outlook. So does our knowledge of the fact that the Buddha knew all the Dhammas, that there was nothing unknown to him. Again, we know that the practice of the Buddha's teaching prevents one from landing in the lower worlds, that it contributes to the attainment of prosperity on earth, celestial bliss, or nibbanic peace, that the Dhamma can be realized for oneself, that one gets instant benefit from its practice. Such a knowledge of the Dhamma means nobility of character. The same is true of our knowledge about the Sangha. The Sangha is dedicated to morality, samadhi and wisdom, for the conquest of greed, hatred and ignorance, and so reverence for the Sangha is beneficial in terms of longevity, health, etc. This knowledge about the Sangha will certainly enhance our moral stature. Ennobling power of the wise man's Dhamma. Initially, children know little about the Buddha, the Sangha, and the Dhamma. They have no moral standard to speak of. When they grow up and become a little intelligent, wise parents teach them to revere the Sangha and the memory of the Buddha and impress on them the benefits resulting from such reverence. They teach the children the refuge formula. I take refuge in the Buddha, etc. Thus, as a formally established Buddhist, the child is free from rebirth in the lower worlds. Then the child is taught the solemn undertaking in regard to the five moral precepts and their application to daily life. It is up to parents to teach the child the essentials of Buddhism, and if they are not equal to the task, they should entrust him to the care of a good teacher. Good parents teach the child the recitation of only texts and formulas. Thus, thanks to the intelligence and wisdom of parents, children are assured of spiritual heritage that contributes to their moral development. Conformity to the Buddha's teaching. When a boy grows up, he gives alms and observes the precepts, thereby ennobling his character. He hears the sermon on mind training that conforms to the Buddha's teaching, meditates rightfully, and so enhances his moral stature. Here we should be mindful of the need for conformity to the Buddha Dharma and correct approach to meditation. There are teachers whose doctrines do not accord with the Dharma as well as yogis, who practice that meditation in the wrong way. These people misunderstand and disparage the true teaching, thereby degrading themselves spiritually. Even the effort to develop concentration, samatha bhavana, in accordance with the Buddha's teaching is noble. Some tend to belittle the practice of concentration, but this is due to their ignorance, for in reality, samatha bhavana, which leads to the attainment of jhana, is beneficial to the yogi. It is most beneficial if the jhana forms the basis for insight meditation, vipassana. This is the excellent way of the Buddha and his chief disciples. So the practice of samatha is noble, but more noble is the practice of vipassana. Purity and insight knowledge. Vipassana. Yogis who meditated at this center did not at first know thoroughly the method of meditation. Some were wholly ignorant of it. They became familiar with it, as well as the development of vipassana, through old yogi friends, books and sermons. This means, of course, an advance in their spiritual outlook. Indeed, we may take for granted such an advance at every stage in the development of vipassana jnana. These stages are concentration and tranquility through mindfulness or purity of mind, citta visuddhi. The yogi finds only corporeality as the object of mindfulness and consciousness as the subject, ditti visuddhi. And then he finds causal connection between them, kanka vitara na visuddhi, a stage which the Visuddhi Magga describes as that of a chula sotapanna, who will not usually be reborn in the lower worlds. Then the yogi is aware of the arising and vanishing, together with the nature of anicca, dukkha and anatta, udayabhaya jnana, a stage that is marked by illumination, rapture, joy, etc. Then the yogi finds that the watched object, as well as the watching consciousness, dissolves in pairs at every moment of mindfulness, bhanga jnana. He experiences fear at every moment, bhaya jnana. Then awareness of evil, adina va jnana. Then disgust, nibbida jnana. Then the desire to detach oneself, munjitu kamyata jnana. Then re-examination and special knowledge, patisankanyana, then equanimity in regard to pleasant and unpleasant objects, sankharupekanyana. The yogi is then very close to the goal. Before long, he has special, sharp insight knowledge, leading to the extinction of mind-body complex formations. Rupa, nama, sankhara, that is realization or nibbana through the four paths, magas, and four fruitions, palas. This is the apex of spiritual development. Thus, every successive stage in the development of insight knowledge marks a further advance in spiritual life. Royal chariots subject to old age. The third stanza says, "The royal chariots, which are so exquisite and splendid, became old." In ancient times, the chariots which the kings as heads of state rode were very beautiful and majestic. They were, of course, not like modern motor vehicles. Motor cars have been in vogue only for a century, and prior to their appearance, they were only horse-drawn coaches. They were so gorgeous and splendid that a new coach might have fascinated many people. But in spite of its magnificence, a coach used by a king became old in the time of his successors, and it was worn out and almost unserviceable by the time of his grandson. Some kings reigned for 50 or 60 years. Among such kings, even the coaches used in the early years of the reign became old after 15 or 20 years. The same is true of royal coaches today. The latest model of a car may be an object of admiration, but it is bound to become out of fashion after 25 or 30 years. It becomes ugly and obsolete as against a new model. It is said that officials and rich people have to buy new cars, since their sons and daughters scorn old cars. New houses and brick buildings are fine, but they become old within 50 or 60 years. Rajagaha and Sarvati were magnificent Indian cities in the lifetime of the Buddha, but today their sites are covered with bushes and jungles without any remains of human dwellings. The ancient glorious cities of Pagan and Avar are now small villages. Like the royal coaches, majestic buildings also become old and fall into decay.